Rammstein@gmail.com. Thank you for listening.
Rose City Native Radio is looking for folks in the Native community who knew the late, great John Talley, host of Indian World for over 30 years.
My name is John Talley, and I'm the producer of a program called Indian World.
We are currently planning a special to celebrate the 30-plus years of Indigenous programming here on KABU, and we want to hear your stories of John Talley and programming here at KABU. If you know anybody in the Native community who would like to tell us a story about John, please email us at pdxnativeradio@gmail.com or call 503-231-8032 extension 221 and speak with Aaron.
KABU Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Personnel Committee will meet on the second Monday of each month at 6 p.m.
KBOO Portland.
You're listening to Between the Covers. Today in the studio, we have Nancy Huang, and she's going to be talking about her first book, Favorite Daughter, out right now by Right Bloody. I'm Pamela Santos, your host. Nancy Huang grew up in America and China. She is the winner of an Andrew Julius Guttow Academy of American Poets Prize, a James F. Parker Award in Poetry, a 2015 Young Arts Finalist Prize, and a Regents Arts and Humanities Award finalist. Her work has been recognized by the Library of Congress, the Scholastic Art and Writing Awards, the Michigan Young Playwrights Festival, and Letters About Literature. Nancy's a Vona and Tin House Fellow. She has also mentored writers for Winter Tangerine Review and Barrio Writers. Welcome to Between the Covers, Nancy.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited.
Let's start with a couple of excerpts from your book.
Okay. All right. I'm going to read from my book a poem called Tooth Fairy. Tooth Fairy. My skeleton is always grinning, even when I scream. White ridges stacked in an upturned curve, pearls strung up over a clavicle. I do not own my skeleton. Teeth rotting, a science experiment. Seventh grade, the table next to me had white pearls shrinking in cola. This was a message. Remember, your body will not forgive you for hunger, for warmth escaping. In China, there's a place called Wuxi, established in the Song Dynasty. All the fish in the river come out sweet because of some long-forgotten legend. They sprinkle rock sugar in all their dishes until they are inedible to outsiders. When people ask why, they say, our ancestors passed this down to us, this desire to drown in sucrose, this hunger for candy. My ancestors gave me a craving to dissolve in sugar. I have never had a cavity in my life, but the first girl I kissed had mint hair, bubblegum lips, fleshy eyes, wet, shrinking smile in cola, metal bracketing her mouth in barbed wire braces. A nightmare. Ma said, smile big, it'll catch a boy. Dentist said, perfect gums, but where are your teeth? The next poem I'm going to read is called A Hymn to Shanghai. A Hymn to Shanghai, after Lin Yutang. See, this is how you sing to the great, terrible city. Bribe it with good fortune. Feed it a logic riddle. These are good things to give to certain locations. Do you believe in ghosts? No. I believe in being haunted. I wish you could be done with the place and have it not haunt you. I'm wishing for too much. Shanghai, which is upon the sea, which is fairy tale. I used to be afraid of how unknowable the sea was, its vast reach, its love for flesh, its hunger for deep. They always say in fairy tales you get 3 shots. I'm American, strike 1. I'm China native, strike 2. There, the ocean is flooding between the city streets, traffic gridlocked all over. Gray sky. You know you're in China when... How a city can spill into a river, into the sea. If everyone here is a liar, how can I believe you when you tell me beggars, babes, and billionaires? How can you feel a place outside of your body? Isn't your body the end-all, be-all? Aren't the faces in the river your face, too? Aren't you still in the river? Didn't you fall in once? You never made it out. Other people waded to shore. You stayed. They left, and the city changed. You stayed. No one ever thanked you for staying there, for laying down, for keeping the river warm. The next poem I'm going to read is called Google Translate, How to Come Out of the Closet. My grandfather was the one who told me that women loving women is Lala. Lala for Lily, Lala for Paul, Lala for the print on my pillows. Bole for love, Bole for women, and Bole for glass. Then there's Pinze for vase, Pinze for bottle, Pinze for gay. We only have a handful of words for ourselves, a flimsy grasp on this language. I don't even know which ones are slurs. I try and fit Lily into my mouth, put the glass on my tongue, and shimmy it out of my jaw. It turns into sky, paper, bush. I try again and it turns into tired. I'm not supposed to confuse tones or dialects, the same way I'm not supposed to say the word for the number 4. I bastardize this language. Yue lian for moon bright, min yue for bright moon, xiao for small, and xiao for smile. America has ruined my tongue for me. Mei guo for home. Jia for home, but jia also means family. Jia is a word that's an oxymoron of itself. Lala. I say it without the accent, and it becomes a song. Yeah, yeah, I still love men. Yeah, yeah, there's not a word in this 5,000-year-old language for what I am. Yeah, yeah, I don't think my jia will love me if I tell. Yeah, yeah, I don't know what to say, and you can't teach me. 我没有一个名字. Jia huin for marriage and li huin for divorce, but yeah, yeah, I can't invent another word for love. You told me Chinese is so old that English cannot keep up. You told me there's a flower in China with no English word for it. You told me that we have a word for everything, that this language would never fail me. Lala, 但是我还喜欢男子. I repeat it until the river runs. Lily, but I still love men. Lily, but I still love. Lily, but I am, but I am.
All of this was so beautiful.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much for letting me read these poems, too. I'm very emotional.
Well, there's a lot of emotion in these poems. How do you decide what poems you're going to either read in public or read to other people?
I think that audience has a lot to do with it. So when I'm thinking about, you know, performing at a slam venue or a bar, I really consider, like, oh, what city is this in? Who makes up this crowd? Who primarily, you know, comes to and is a patron of these businesses? And, you know, what have they not heard yet? Or what have they not considered? In slam venues especially, when they bring in artists and different poets, the way that they connect to the audience is a part of their performance. So it's very important to consider what to read versus who's going to hear it and who needs to hear it the most.
So when you're talking about who needs to hear it, let's name what we're talking about. Because you and I are sharing kind of a shared knowledge. Even if it's unspoken, it's because we're here in this space. And for me, being a Filipina American, I know exactly what you mean. But I really want to hear what you mean.
Mm-hmm, yeah. Overtly, I mean people of color. I mean queer people, especially queer people of color who maybe live in communities where they are outsiders or they're not maybe accepted, but either way, anyone who listens to my stuff should know that, like, I never want it to be erased that I'm queer. I never want it to be erased that I'm Chinese American. These things make up my entire existence, and they make up other people's too. And the fact that a lot of people who are marginalized are told to be erased a lot, or, you know, make themselves smaller or shrink themselves down, is something that I'm averse to, and I want my work to be averse from that. So whenever I go to a venue or a different place while on tour, I'm always like, okay, if there are queer people of color here, they need to hear this poem, and they need to, you know, connect with that aspect of my identity.
Are there ever considerations you make for people who are not in the room? And you can take that as a metaphysical as well.
Because there's metaphysically not in the room.
I know.
Yeah.
I know.
No, that's an important question too. Again, I think that every room you step into it really depends on who makes up that room still, you know? And I think that if I went into a venue that didn't have any white people, I would feel, okay, there are these, you know, poems that work for audiences like this, and, like, I can do those. And if I go into a room that's primarily full of white people, and if there's, like, no one around, I'm gonna say same thing. Like, there are poems that these people need to hear, and, like, that's not, you know, code switching. It's not code switching between, oh, how I talk to white people or how I talk to people of color. It's mm-hmm. just... you know, these poems that are my existence, and who gets to hear them at any time, which is why I'm thinking a lot about, you know, how to make my work more accessible to everyone.
And that consideration that you make for accessibility, and also for even thinking about erasure, do you think that's an organic part of your writing practice, your writing process?
I think so, yes, but it didn't start out that way. Okay. I think that when I first started writing poetry, I was in high school. But when I first started sending out poetry, that was in college, and I didn't really give much consideration to who was reading the journals I was sending them out to. So as a question of accessibility, like, that never really occurred to me, and, like, I know it should have, and I know that... There are some pieces out there that are in these prestigious literary journals, but like, for example, you have to, like, get a physical copy or pay to, you know, buy it, to own it, to read my poems. So I've been trying really, really hard to make sure that some of my stuff is online and free, and the rest of it can be in this book. Like, I want a good mix of, you know, you can pay for my labor and my work and my creativity, but also if you can't, which a lot of people can't, it's also, like, some taste of it is online, and, like, you can find it there.
What do you think about how people talk about poetry being accessible or not being accessible?
I think primarily poetry is accessible. Like, overall, as a blanket statement, yes, poetry is accessible. I think when you get into certain segments or subgenres of it, it becomes more complicated, because there are things in the poetry community that not everyone can do, such as writing retreats or, you know, these very, very big prestigious journals that are kind of obscure, but also they're reading for something very specific that not everyone writes about, or slam venues that are, like, are problematic or whatever, and they don't showcase, you know, writers or poets who aren't white. So, like, there's a lot of complicated things with visibility that I think are in poetry, and I think that's what's behind the inaccessibility when people say that. If you think of poetry, or, you know, any literature as an institution, you know who's at top, and you know who's, you know, editing everything, and who's screening, basically, you know, the gatekeepers. You know who's screening everything past them, and that's not that doesn't speak to my experience, and that doesn't speak to a lot of people's experience either.
And it's great that we are talking about things like this, because I still think that, I think some of what your book tackles is thinking about power, thinking about who has it, thinking about how people see themselves also, I think goes a lot into power. And what do you have in terms of thinking about that when you're writing, you know, What are you trying to ruminate, meditate on, maybe come up with an answer to?
It's funny when you say power, because now I'm thinking about everyone who holds societal or institutional power over me. And I remember one of my mentors and friends, Ariana Brown, who's an amazing poet, told me that she made a promise to herself a long time ago to stop explaining things to white people in her poems, because it was taking up too much space in her poetry, first of all, and it was taking up too much, too much time or labor, emotional and mental labor for her to do the explaining. And I remember that hit me so hard. And I think that with this book, that's what I tried to do. Thankfully, I talked to her before, the final draft. And I went to my editor. I said, hey, there's a poem in there that has dictionary definitions. It's a dictionary poem. It's called Google Translate, How to Come Out of the Closet. And I want to keep it in there, but I also want to look at it as the time I wrote it, and it was written in a time where I was still going through that phase of I have to explain my existence to other people who don't get it. So we italicized the words that come before the definitions, and I think that that poem still has a place, in the world and in this collection. I think that it has a place being read out loud and performed in venues. I still perform that piece. I love that poem. It's just, I have a different consideration. I have a different perspective on it now, just because Ariana told me, hey, sometimes you have to let them figure it out, or you have to let them not get it, or if you let them not understand you.
It's interesting when we look at the genres, because it's hard to even say and pull. Like with prose, you might have the categorization, the separation of fiction and nonfiction. And here, I just find that it's almost impossible to make that kind of line between what's fictional and what is supposedly truth.
I think Lucy Wagner did an interview with Winter Tangerine before, and I remember when she was being interviewed, someone asked her about, oh, you write fiction and poetry, what's the difference between them? A very, very old question that everyone's been asked before. And she had such a unique spin. She said, I think that it's easier and more acceptable to kind of cover things up in fiction. But if you're doing that in poetry, then you're being a coward. So I think that when thinking about truth and writing, because I also write fiction. I start out as a fiction writer. Thinking about truth and writing, I think that I'm part of her school of thought, where if you're writing things in poetry and they're not honest, then I don't know. There's really a separate purpose that you're maybe working towards that's different. And I believe that fabrication can exist in poetry, and it can be good. It can be good even. It's just I don't know if those people who fabricate are doing it for whatever reason that is productive to them, as in a sense, because when I think about what poetry means to me, it's just telling the truth and making sure my voice is out there and known. And it's very, very different. It's a very different consideration I have from fiction.
So you have different sections here. You read two poems from part two, which is titled Shanghai. Part one was immigration. Part three was America. Part four was assimilation. And I find it great that you had different poems in each one that really covered, what that means to put them in sections. And then they also kind of bleed onto each other. So it's not like there is a hard separation between that, because when we're looking at immigration and assimilation, right? There's still something there. And it's really interesting that they're bookends as well. So the bookends of immigration and assimilation. And I think when I look at it, I look at what does it mean that you are putting a kind of truth in these poems? And what does it mean when you can be honest on the page? When do you know that you're being honest on the page?
Wow. Yeah. Thank you for pointing that out to me. I think that a for sure sign that I'm being honest on the page is when I have to take a step back from it
and I have to like give it space and let it sit in a drawer for like maybe a few weeks or months, and you know, then go back to it later, because I don't know, there's something, it's not a draining process or something or anything for me, but there's something like very, very, very intense that forces me to take space away from it later. So that's a good sign when I'm writing it. And as for the structure of the book too, like, I'm so glad you brought that up, because it's broken up into four sections, and I divided it, I divided all the poems and put them into these categories, and I think that they're in that order because someone told me once that immigration is not a linear narrative, it's circular. You know, so if you look at stories or fiction, even like fiction or poetry, about just any writing or art in general, if you look at stories about immigration, they're always going to the place that you're immigrating to, and they always come back. There's always a movement of coming back. There's always this kind of backward momentum. And whether they, you know, use it with as a memory, like, you know, whether it's memory or whether you're remembering the old country or whether it's actually physically going back, like, you know, it's exemplified in my book. That's, you know, it's always there, always. And when I heard that, I was like, man, I need to structure this in a way that kind of represents that circle. You know, that circular narrative. And I think some books or some poetry collections, they work in a straight line. You know, it's fine if you have a linear direction, you're going in a straight line. This one works in a spiral, kind of. It starts with immigration, you know, and then that's going to America. Then it's, the part two is Shanghai, which is the backward momentum, it's going back. And then part three is America, because we went to America again. So for this book, it's kind of more of a spiral than a circle, because I go back and forth. And the last part is assimilation. Yeah, I think those parts, like, really, this is like my entire life, basically. I grew up here because my parents are immigrant professionals, and then we moved to Shanghai, then we moved back here, and this is where I've been since, and I've never gone back to Shanghai, but I always return to it in memories. So it's like a very spiral-ish shape, if we're talking about, you know, the shape this collection takes. I think that the majority of the feelings I have regarding China were developed when I was very young, because I lived there when I was 8 for 3 years, and then I moved back. So I think I'm trying to return to that childhood of being in a new place that's not supposed to look new to you. Like, it's supposed to be my culture. It's supposed to belong to me, but it feels like it doesn't. You know, I remember one very, very particular memory I have of living in Shanghai. I remember our school, I went to an international school that had this international day, you know, the kind of tokenizing, like, little the day where everyone dresses up in their home culture and they bring in, like, a little dish. And I put on a qi pao for the very first time. And I thought that I looked so weird in it, and it didn't fit me. And I thought, this is supposed... Wait a second. This is supposed to be mine. You know, this is supposed to belong to me, and I'm supposed to feel okay in this. And it was a very, very... It was a very interesting thing to think about also, with regard to, you know, being an international student and also, you know, being American in an international city. I don't know. I think I'm always trying to reassure that little girl that, like, oh, you know, it doesn't have to, you don't have to feel any particular way. It's totally chill. You're fine. Do what you got to do. I'm still trying to do that, though, you know, go back to childhood, which I think is a common narrative for a lot of poets.
And do you think you're going to keep coming back to that in your future poetry?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I don't think I'm done with it yet.
Is writing supposed to be a mode for fulfillment? What does it have to do with fulfillment, you know, for people?
Mm.
I mean, speak for yourself, definitely.
Yeah, yeah. I think I can only speak for myself. I don't want to tramp on anyone else's truth. Yeah. Yeah, so some people, I know that Google Translate was a poem that I wrote for fulfillment, because I was feeling, oh, you know, Chinese is such an old language, but there's not really a word for people like me. You know, there's not anything. There's a lot of, you know, allegorical language you can use to cover women who love women. There's a lot of metaphorical language. There's a lot of allusions you can make and in the language to refer to people like me, but there's never been an overt way to say bisexual or pansexual. And that was very upsetting to me when I learned that. And so, you know, I wrote a poem out of it. And after that, though, I did feel that, you know, sense of completion. I do think that this poem is done the way that it is in the book. And a lot of people don't feel that way about any of their poetry, which is fine and very interesting. I'm very, very interested in, like, you know, learning how people just don't ever move on to the final stage, or just, you know, are in this perpetual cycle of, you know, no, this isn't done. This needs more work. Everything needs more work.
Do you think that on some level you write for yourself?
Yeah, definitely.
Mm-hmm. When did you start to write for yourself, you think?
Oh, God. Probably around the time when I was doing workshops and talking to people like Ariana Brown, who told me, you know, stop writing things for white people and stop explaining things to white people, you know, because her philosophy was that you don't have to write for anyone, but you can be writing for yourself and have no one understand you and have, you know, your own languages and hybridity and your own understanding of yourself and your work. And that was very different from what I was taught beforehand, which is, oh, you know, poetry as consumption, poetry as a product, and poetry as kind of a vehicle for other people to understand you. But they don't need to, you know?
Do you feel like there's ways that you're going to keep exploring poetry, that in the same way, do you think you're moving in a different direction? Like, what's ahead of you?
Oh, man. I haven't given much thought to this yet. I think that I'm very, very interested in, right now at least, in math and how that interacts with poetry. Because, like, you know, we've been talking about shapes and the geometry of poetry for quite a while. And I think that that's because I brought up those shapes because I'm thinking about math right now. And it seems like a completely random thing to think about, but it's just... when I was younger, I used to be super terrible at math, and that was something that, like, I thought I'd never be good at. There's no aspect of this that I could ever identify with. I'm going back to that now, and I'm going back to, like, you know, all the math homework that I did as a little kid and what I hated about it. I'm looking, like, at these boxes and boxes, because my parents never throw anything out. These boxes and boxes of, like, you know, papers and math problems and tests, and it's, like, old stuff, like, fascinating stuff. And I'm looking at, you know, what I used to hate about math and thinking about how I could apply that to, you know, something that I thought was completely opposite to language and to poetry. That kind of hybridity that I'm looking for in both these realms.
So there is a place for math in poetry.
Yeah,
and science.
Who knew? Yeah. I remember, like, reading Ada Lovelace's Wikipedia page, and just because I have a very strange fascination with who she was and, like, you know, the things she did. Ada Lovelace is the Enchantress of Numbers, known for being the mother of computer science, basically. She was a brilliant mathematician. The thing is, her mom was a genius at math, and her father was the poet Lord Byron, and they were very ill-matched for each other. You know, so, like, that kind of represented to Ada, like, the two worlds that kind of really don't collide. But then as she grew older, she coined this phrase that I love. It's called poetical science, and she kind of marries the two, kind of. Even though her parents were, their marriage ended, they were divorced, but, like, she kind of married the two in her work because she believed that there's this false dichotomy that says, oh, math and poetry are completely separate. They're never the same. They're different. Done. And she rejected that completely. So, like, there's something about that philosophy that I really like. So I'm trying to discover more about, you know, what I can do with numbers or what I can do with shapes, geometry, what I can do with algebra and poetry even. I wrote a poem recently. So, like, you know, this is what I'm working on now. I wrote a poem recently where I wrote out an equation and had an unknown variable in my life. And then I worked it out like a proof, like a math problem on the page. And I was like, oh, okay, let X equal this. And then just work it out through language. It's very, like, the work I'm doing right now is very interesting. I'm very excited to see, like, you know, what happens next.
And it's material that you feel this is new territory for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, like, I've talked to my friend, one of my friends from high school who's a very good mathematician, right? I asked him once, oh, you're studying math at MIT. Can you tell me the most beautiful equation you know? And the way he described it sounded like a poem. So I was like, wow, there's not a lot of difference between what he's doing and what I'm trying to do. You know, like our worlds, we live in the same world, kind of. You know, I always thought it was different. It's not.
Thank you so much for joining us. This is a great, I'm so glad I got to have you in the studio.
No, thank you. Thank you so much for this great opportunity. This is so exciting. Like, this is like huge microphone in front of me. This is all so like incredible. I've never done anything like this. I'm so excited. I'm like a newbie trying to touch everything. yeah.
You've been listening to Between the Covers. I'm Pamela Santos with Nancy Huang, and her book you can get from Right Bloody Publishing is titled Favorite Daughter. The music in our program, I See You, was provided by Portland producer Nathaniel Zablon at nathanieljams.com. Have a good one. Thank you.
Welcome to Words and Pictures, the show about the narrative arts scene. I'm your host, S.W. Conser, and today we're celebrating a return visit from our first ever guest on the show. That was back in 2003 when his graphic novel Blankets first hit the shelves. He's also the creator of Habibi, Space Dumplings, and Goodbye Chunky Rice, and he's recently re-released his sketchbook travel.